This conference is being recorded.
Today is Sabbath, January the 9th, 2009, and we're starting our recording. So far, we had started on the preface, and if anyone is online, if they have the book, you can turn to the preface. If you don't have the book, you can... Online, I have the preface that you can click on it, and it'll let you go straight to the preface. As we mentioned earlier, we just want to make sure everybody gets a chance to read the syllabus and be able to follow it and sign up for the class. Okay, in the with what we've been discussing for the last few weeks, we were trying to get a background on the situations that we find ourselves in, as I call it, the great dilemma. And so we have to make decisions, and we have to start be able to wake up and see what's going on. Now, some people are seeing through what's going on and seeing a matrix, seeing all different type of things. And I had mentioned in my first paragraph that turned me to relook and reexamine everything was the disturbing contradictions and inconsistencies that I saw. And last week we discussed what contradictions and inconsistencies that we see. And I believe a lot of other people were actually seeing the same thing I was seeing, just different things, but they saw lots of inconsistencies and contradictions. I'm sure everybody who's online now have been seeing contradictions and inconsistencies. And so as time went on, when we go down to the second paragraph, we started to realize the different things or the circumstances of our thinking, depending on what decisions we make or decisions we don't make. And around midway, it talks about John 18, verse 38, where Pilate asks Yeshua, what is truth? And that is the main question of today. What is truth? Because most of us are in a maze or in an illusion, as I can put it, of what is real. And so what America has called it is the American dream. And so as we try to filter through the American dream to find out what is truth and what isn't truth and what is right and what is wrong and what's a contradiction, what are the inconsistencies, we think sometimes about our generations that have gone before. And I had asked my parents and my grandparents to actually see if they saw it. They said they saw it, but there wasn't much they could do about it but tell us to get an education, so that we can be able to filter through and see what's going on. And so the same thing, this happened to me around in my 20s when I was at college, and now a lot of young people are coming to the same realization as I did and as many of us do and did. And many people are trying to decide, especially young people, of why are they here on the planet? What is our purpose? What is our goal? Are we supposed to believe in the American dream, or are we supposed to think for ourselves and start realizing where we are in time and in history? When we come down to the third paragraph, we talk a little bit about Matthew 25 and Matthew 13. I guess we can read some of that. We are dead asleep. According to Matthew 25 and 13, we were not conscious to the truth and reality. We were fed flagrant deception in almost every aspect of life. About this time, someone might be saying, this can't be true, because we have watchdogs, people we have put in position of trust, our leaders, politicians, pastors, teachers, are paid through our taxes and tithes They are hired to look out for all of our interests and not the rich and famous. They would have told us if these things were true. Hopefully now every generation can see that our leaders do not care about us, we the people. Their economic bailout for $700 billion is for the rich and famous, Wall Street, the bankers, the car companies like Ford and etc. And when we talk about Matthew 25, is everyone familiar with Matthew 25, the 10 virgins parable?
I've read it, but I need to go back and
okay, because I don't want to, you know, assume everybody's read it or familiar with what I'm talking about. Okay, if you have your Bible, you can turn to Matthew 25, and I'm going to read it so that we can all be on the same page. I always like to make sure that everybody's, as they say, following along.
Yes.
Otherwise, I'm just talking to myself, which makes no sense. Okay, in Matthew chapter 25, we're starting at verse 1. This is Yeshua talking. Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins, which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. And 5 of them were wise, and 5 were foolish. They that were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. While the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. Now, I want to pause there for a minute. So what we're talking about here is a parable of at night. That's when people usually went and had their wedding and their feast and all of those different things. And here it makes mention that we had 10 people, 10 virgins who were waiting for the bridegroom to come. That's what it says, that they were tarrying for the bride and the bridegroom, for the marriage and for the feast and all of those different things. And it makes mention that there were 5 wise and 5 foolish. Now, the question is, what is the difference between the foolish virgin and the wise virgin? Because as we read on, we're finding out that 5 took oils with their lamps. That's what the wise did. And the foolish took not oil with their lamp. So all of them were virgins. All of them had lamps. But one group took oil and another group did not take oil. And in verse 5 says, while the bridegroom tarried, or the maid, they all slumbered and slept. Now, I guess another major question is, if they're all sleeping, what makes the difference between a wise and a foolish person? And so we have to realize and think about that, because I thought about when we talking about with Yeshua and his disciples. He asked them to pray while he went to pray. And we find out that the disciples went to sleep too. So there we find again, not just the 10 virgins, the wise and the foolish sleeping, but we also find the disciples sleeping when they are called forth to pray. And so we think about ourselves in this time, and at least most of us could realize and can think about the times that we've been sleeping. And now with, you know, is it time to awake is the question. The next verse says in verse 6, this is Matthew 24, verse 6, and at midnight, the darkest time in earth's history, the darkest time, and at midnight there was a cry made, behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose, as the wise and the foolish, and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said unto the wise, Give us of your oil, for our lamps are gone out. But the wise answered, saying, Not so, lest there be not enough for us and you. But go ye rather to them that sell, and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and they that were ready went in with him to the marriage, and the door was shut. Afterward came also the other virgin, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. And he answered and said, Verily I say unto you, I know you not. Watch therefore, for ye know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. So that's the parable of the 10 virgins. A lot of little things should be clicking off in our minds. Like one question is, I mean, we already talked about the difference between the wise and the foolish. And we talked about everybody falling asleep just like the disciples. And most likely most of us have fallen asleep and now we're trying to wake back up. The question really is, what arises or awakens the 10 virgins while they're asleep? And the thing that came to my mind was that as if a person is sleeping, what do they know is going on around them? Are they conscious of their surroundings, of where they are? If someone comes into their house and robs them, would they know that someone is there? If they're sleeping, if someone is putting false information in their room or wherever, would they know? And the answer would be for all of those, no, they wouldn't be conscious of anything. So people can be telling you things, doing things to you, and you would have no clue that they're doing anything to you. And I think that's the situation we've been finding ourselves in. We have been so unconscious to reality that people have been there feeding us misinformation just so that we can act on it. As some would call it, subliminal subduction or the hidden hand. There's some books on there that talks about how this happens. And as some would say today, as we have the Matrix, most people are sleeping in the Matrix. And one day they wake up. If they, as some would say, if you get a blue or red pill. And so as we move forward, our young people are starting to awaken to seeing what's going on. And there's two things we can do for them. We can do like everybody else, put them back to sleep. And that's, you know, teaching the same things or saying the same things that everybone else has been saying. And it just rocks you right to sleep. Or we awaken people with the light. And that's what, notice between the wise and the foolish. The foolish said that their lamps have gone out. So they had no more light to share with anybody. And it didn't say they didn't have light before because they had lamps before. And the only difference is they didn't take an extra oil and took not oil with their lamps. And so that's where we find ourselves in reference to what is truth or what is light, as some would say. And so as we, last week, we started on the next two paragraphs, the next three paragraphs, where we started talking about, we asked them some basic questions, because most people think that the church is supposed to warn you of what's going on. The pastor's job is to tell you what's going on. As some would say, that our politicians are supposed to protect us, and as we've been seeing, we pay them to do that, but there's another agenda that's being run. Now, and it says, let us see what basic information we should know that relate to people of color, but we were never told. What continent and or land masses hold the formation of Judaism and Christianity? Now, last week we cleared up what those answers were. So we would like to get everybody's answer today, and then we'll move right along, because I assume we don't have to re-explain it.
We said, let me find the map. We talked about the Kush, the land of Kush.
Okay.
The Havilah.
Okay, Havilah is not up there, is it?
No.
We got Europe, Asia, the Americas,
okay,
Africa, know. Land of Ham, land of Kush, or the land of Kemet.
Kemet, right. And that's Kush.
Now, which land masses have the formation of Judaism and Christianity, and that's where they came from?
Africa.
Okay, Africa is one of them, okay.
One. Asia. Well, Europe is one. No, I know it didn't come from there. And Africa, well, Kush is Africa. I guess there's the three here, Europe, Asia, and Africa and America. What continent? Well, yeah, it's America, Africa, and Europe.
Now we're asking what land masses, because there's more than one, that actually hold and that the formation of Christianity and Judaism came from.
That it came from?
Yeah.
That's
where it came from. Where they originated from. Or that's what some would call their mama or papa or their root.
Well, I would say it came from Kush. I mean, they're land masses.
Yep, land masses. Mm-hmm.
Kush and Kemet. And Africa. I mean, but
okay.
That's the same, right?
Okay, so you're saying there's three of them.
Yeah.
Land, which three?
I'm saying Africa.
Okay.
But it didn't come from Europe. I can rule out Europe, Asia, and America. So I have to say that it came from the land of Kush, the land of Kemet, and Africa.
Okay. Good. And Bobby? Is Bobby still on?
Oh.
Okay. Anybody else still on? I didn't hear any beeps. Okay. Yes, so now what about the land of Ham?
I would say land of Ham too.
Okay. Now the key is, what does these words mean? What is the land of Ham?
The land of Ham is the, they named, if the sun is one of the sun. It's the land of Ham because the people identify themselves with the land.
The land of Ham is Africa. I was on, Emmanuel. I had just Star 6, so anything going on in my background.
Yeah, I understand. Okay.
I was listening to the gentleman. My understanding is that Africa, the land of Ham, the land of Kush, and the land of Kemet are all the same.
No, they're not all the same. Because the land of Kemet is where people who are of Kemet live.
The land of Kemet is in Africa.
Right.
Okay, and the land of Kush is in Africa.
Right, everything south of the
land
of Kush
is Africa. So the answer I would think would be Africa, would be all four of the lands. Well, Kemet, like you said, the land of Kemet, you know, is on the continent of Africa, but I think the answer that you're looking for is Africa, but it's, you know.
Yeah, all four of them. Yeah,
all four of them are Africa.
Yeah, right, because in the land of Kemet, of what we call today Egypt, that's where they go to get all the documentation. So we know it was there, and whenever we see they're having trouble, whenever we see Abraham, they're having famine, they go down there to Kemet. Whenever Isaac has famine, he goes down to Kemet. We also find out that that Yeshua, that he sent down to Kemet by the angel. We find out after 78, after the Babylonian destruction, that Jeremiah and the survivors, they go down into Kemet. So we see a constant influx of them going down into Kemet. And on top of that, the Exodus was from Kemet. Well, yeah, that's where everything was. The land of Cush is everything south of Egypt, or what we call the land of Kemet, and also the land of Cush is where the Cushites dwell. The lands, when it says the land of Ham, that just tells us that the children of Ham lived in those lands. That's all it's trying to tell us. See, they're trying to make it simple for us in case people changed up the names later, which they did. You could still identify it. So if you can identify the children of Ham, then wherever they lived, that's called the land of Ham. And that includes Cush, which is everything south of Egypt. That includes Put, which is what we call today Libya. And that's everything that we, in North Africa, and what we call the land of Kemet, you know, Egypt is in North Africa. And then the Canaanites, the land of Canaan is what the rephrasing of the term they call the Middle East today. And that's where the land of Ham was. So yes, it encompassed all of what we call ancient Africa or old Africa, which includes what we call today Africa and the Middle East. And the land of Cush extended all the way over to, because Nimrod was the son of Cush, and so Nimrod's empire was between the Tigris and the Euphrates. And so we're talking about all the way over to what they classify today as the Middle East was all run and is part of the land of Cush. And the land of Kemet, their empire extended, in my book I show you, it included the land of Canaan at times. So yes, all of those lands. Now Europe was not part, Europe did not have any formation of Christianity or Judaism. And Asia, what we call today Asia, that portion is not the foundation. But in Europe and in Asia is where they hide all of the jewels and the documentation that they took out of Africa, that documents all of this information.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I was reading this because I think it gives us a distinction. Because when we talk about Kemet, it's what they renamed Egypt. But from what I've read from other documents, the Cushite people, and I'm just trying to understand this to make sure I'm clear. The Cushites were up where the city of Meroe was. Well, it actually was two cities, but there was an older city, which they called the ancient city. And from what I was reading, that the Cushites and those people in the ancient cities were really, well, they called them of Negroid feature, but they said that they were really, they were the people of the document, keeping the documents. And the people from Kemet, they really learned from them. So I guess when you were saying that, even though that they were the same, it seems like to me that from what I was reading, that they were saying that those Kemet was where they said like the mud ran down the Kemet, and that's how Egypt came about to get formed. So in the context of what you're putting it in, I'm just want the Cushite. I'm just trying to see how.
Oh, I can clarify that. Not a problem.
Okay.
What actually happened was what we call Upper and Lower Egypt,
okay,
or the land of Kemet, Upper and Lower Kemet, is Upper Kemet, or Egypt, is what we refer to the southern sector, and Lower Egypt, or Lower Kemet, is what we refer to that borders the Delta and that borders the Mediterranean, which is the northern part,
okay,
what we call today. The Kemet, the people from Kemet says that they came from the beginning of the Nile.
Yes.
Okay, so they came down from what we would call the southern sector of where the Nubians or Cushites dwelt. And I use Nubian Cushites interchangeably.
Okay.
Okay. Their more ancient name was Nubians, and their more modern name after the flood is Cushite.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm just trying to help us understand. And then when the Greeks come around, then their name is changed to Ethiopians.
Okay,
so I sometimes refer to them as Nubian, Cushite, Ethiopian. So that if someone's reading my book or reading and they don't never heard of the word Cushite or the word Nubian, they can at least identify with Ethiopia.
Okay,
so I'm just trying to make it such that people can, I mean, everybody can be on coordination together. Now, then, in my book, in the first chapter, we deal with the four rivers, and we talk about the first river, which is down in the Great Lake region, which is in what they call the Horn of Africa. And that's where the beginning of the Nile is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the Nubians, or Adam and Eve, who I believe were Nubians, were. That's where they started. And so they would flow, as the river flowed northward, up. The Bible refers to the second river as the Gihon, or the Nile River, what we call today. And so my understanding is that this civilization that started in the Great Lake regions went northward and created what we call the Nile Valley Civilization. So yes, they were the Cushites. And matter of fact, in my second book, we talk about all the major pharaohs in Egypt during their golden ages were all Nubians, or Cushites, or Ethiopians, whichever name you can remember. And so basically, Egypt became a colony of Ethiopia all the way, and that's why I said that as we go northward all the way up to the third and fourth river, which is the Tigris and Euphrates, that's where Nimrod built his empire, who was the son of Cush. So you see this Cushite Nubian empire extending all the way up into that region. And as time goes on, then they break up into different groups, such that now the furthest portion of the Nubian Cushite Ethiopian empire was bordering all the way up to the top of the Tigris Euphrates, or land of Asher or Assyria. And as time went on, they would back down, and other people would conquer them, and that's how you got Babylonia, and that's how you got Media Persia, and other places were conquered. The furthest outreach of the frontier of the Nubian Empire. And then as you go further south, then Egypt started to be attacked, what we call Kemet, or Lower Egypt, the Mediterranean, from the Asians first, and then eventually from the Greeks. And so their empire would back down again. Okay, but mostly, most people did never go into the heart of Africa or in the Horn of Africa to conquer down there where it originated from. So then you had empires that, when they backed off, then you had other Egyptian pharaohs that would arise that were Asian and mixed and this and that. And that's how they became, got their independence. And so you have, yes, that's where they came from. Did that sort of clear up what you were asking?
Yes, it does.
So, okay. Okay, now, we're going to look at the next paragraph here, which refers to the rise of Western culture during the 16th century. Now, in the 16th century, you got to remember, it's the 1500s.
Yes.
Of course, most books, relics, icon, and other religious artifacts in support of Africans' contribution to the formation of Judaism and Christianity to be either destroyed or placed in dungeons throughout Europe and parts of Asia. It was chiefly since the Elba Sarian finding in 1959 and the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls that scholarly interest was awakened to document and research the many biblical truths relating to historical Africa and the Holy Bible. One major interest has been to replace and to restore the historical and biblical Christ of Nazareth was the one given to the Western world by Rome or the Pope. Now, in this, during the 16th century, as they said, the 1500s, the if you read some of the books that were written by the Germans and Great Britain and a lot of the Europeans, especially during the when they were Bible commentary, writing their Bible commentaries, that during this particular time, we find that since they knew or they started to find these relics of the 1500s and 1600s, we see that they started to talk about the enslavement of blacks and all of these different things. Now, the question is, why did white supremacy start at that particular time? Why were they rewriting history? And so the next paragraph, what I tried to do was try to give you a little background and explain what was going on during those time frames, during the 1500s and 1600s. Okay? During the 1500s, the 16th century, immediately after the last Moor, which is black African, was defeated in Europe in 1492 at the beginning of the 1500s, the authorized sanctioned scholars wasted no time to remove all traces of the black African presence in the formation of Judaism and Christianity. Now, what am I saying here? The first question is, you have to be familiar with the Moors. Now, is everyone familiar with the Moors?
I've been reading up on them a little bit.
Okay. All right, the Moors. Now, some people will say the Moors were Muslim.
A lot of people say that.
Say it again?
I said a lot of people say that.
That's right. Okay. But the Moors mean black. Doesn't mean Muslim. Doesn't have nothing. It don't mean Islam. Doesn't mean any of that stuff. But that's what the Eurocentric viewpoint has overlaid, and many people who don't search broad enough, that's what they conclude. But the word Moor does not mean Muslim. It means black. So that means it was sort of like a word Kush, or like Ethiopian, which means burnt-faced people. So this was a description of the people they saw, not the religion that people had at that time. I want to clear that up. That's why I have in parentheses black African. That's what a Moor was. Now, the Moors had conquered. Now, there were Moors that were Christian and Moors that were, as we would call them, Islamic. So, if it meant one, then that means all the black people who were Christians could not have been a Moor. But that's not true when you read back in the ancient literature. Matter of fact, they'll even talk about Victor. He was a commander of some crusaders, and he was a black Moor. They called him, he's a black saint now, and they refer to him as Victor the Moor. Okay, Saint Victor the Moor. Okay, so there is an example of a Moor being a Christian, so then it has nothing to do with Islam. It just has to do with how black you were. Okay? So during this particular time frame, from 700 A.D. until 1492, 700 years, the Moors ruled Spain and Portugal, the southern sector of Europe. And so what we find out is that when the last Moor was defeated, as I had here in 1492, the same year that Christopher came to America, that usually when they have a date and something important happens, they usually cover it up with something else to obscure the us finding out what happened in that year. So 1492 is easy for us to remember because that's when Columbus came. So I always am able to remember that date because of that. But that is the date that the last Moor was defeated in Europe. And after that, we find out in the 1500s that the Pope, one of the Popes, had made a decree that all blacks should be perpetually forever in slavery. And the reason why was because we ruled parts of Europe and during their Dark Ages. Now remember, during the Dark Ages, remember the church is what took them into the Dark Ages, the Pope and all of these characters. And so the places in Portugal and Spain that were under the Moors' rule at that time was not in the Dark Ages. Matter of fact, they were introduced to diet, healthful living, sanitation, university, light, washing, all of the different things were being introduced during that time by the Moors with their Moor science, as some would call it, and presenting it to these people. And so what they wanted to do is to act like that once the Dark Ages ended, that they pulled themselves out of their own darkness of the Dark Ages. But that's not true because of the science of the Moors and because of our being able to rule parts of Portugal and Spain. We were able to introduce them and pull them out of the Dark Ages, as I see it. And so because of that, then that means you would have to rewrite history between 1492, and wipe clean all evidence of Africans ruling parts of Europe. Then that would kill what we call white supremacy. Okay, so that was the first step. So the catch was, if we notice that after 1492 to the 1500s, we're talking about around 8 years, they started getting rid of all the evidence. That's what we read up earlier. The rise of Western culture during the 16th century caused most books, relics, icons, and other religious artifacts in support of African contributions to the formation of Judaism and Christianity to be either destroyed or placed in dungeons throughout Europe and parts of Asia. So that's what was happening during that time frame. Now the next question is that then they got together and put together what they called scholars. Scholars to cover up the truth. And so these are the people that I call authorized, sanctioned scholars. Now the reason why it's this phrase is authorized because they're authorized or commissioned by some organization, religious and state. And that's what makes you authorized. Sanctioned usually is a blessing from the church. And scholars, because you went to, quote unquote, the schools of learning to learn the propaganda so that you can keep it going. And so what we find out is that in the next, the third line, it says, after 100 years of destroying, removing, and renaming all evidence of the black African formation of Judaism and Christianity, then this led the foundation for the foundation of what we of what would happen a century later in the 1700s or the 1600s, 17th century or the 1600s. One, in 611, a new book was written called The Authorized. There's that word again. Authorized Sanctioned Scholars. Now we have the Authorized King James Version of the Bible, the 611 edition. Now remember, we're talking about how many years from them removing and destroying the books and the relics. How many years have passed? Approximately 100 years. Okay, from the 16th century, now we're in the 17th century. From the 1500s, now we're in the 1600s. That's 1611 edition. So they had enough time, 100 years. It depends on how you count generations. If you count generations 40, so you're talking about almost three generations. that they had to do the cover-up. Okay? Number two, the official use of propaganda was announced in the year 1622. Now, what is propaganda? Well, the church said that they were supposed to, the people were supposed to propagate the faith. Now, the basic question is, what faith are they propagating? Now, that was the official version from the Catholic Church, the propaganda of the faith, propagation of the faith. And so when we talk about propaganda, you can look it up in the dictionary, we are talking about a group of cardinals that have gotten together, a group of them, and define what is authorized and what will the church be in sanctioned, and then who will teach it and what scholars will they give to perpetuate the faith. Now, when Egyptology started, most people don't know, but Egyptology was, his goal was to find out what in Egypt would support the Bible. That was the goal of Egyptology. And when they found the different things there, they were very surprised of what they found. And as we had mentioned here, we're talking specifically about the 1600s. And the so now if you go back in time and you look at a lot of the Bible commentaries, mm-hmm. a lot of them started to come out at this time. Matter of fact, some people will say that because of the King James Version of the Bible, the 611 edition, that is when that's what marked the printing of the presses of the Bible, marked the separation of the Dark Ages from the Enlightenment. So that's what most people will tell you. Now, when we're looking here at 1611 and the 1600s, if you go back, you'll find that most of the Bible commentaries that you read, they'll be quoting back to the people that wrote the stuff at that time. So if you look at it, you'll see the proof, and you'll see where they came up with all of these different things. Now, some don't know, but there is something that they call British Israelitism. Now, British Israelitism is the teaching not that the European Jews are the Jews, but that most of the European nation are the 12 tribes of Israel, no, the 10 tribes of Israel, the lost tribes of Israel. So this is what we're talking about that was starting to develop. Because if you're going to realize that these Africans are the ones that pulled them out of the Dark Ages, these Africans are the ones where civilization began, these Africans are the ones who are in this book, then now you have to cover it up and put white supremacy into our, what we would call today, our religion, as we have today. So we have two viewpoints. We have what we call the Eurocentric viewpoint, which is taught in most churches and which we've all been trained in. And then there's another one. Now, this is not called an Afrocentric viewpoint. It's just a truth viewpoint. I don't believe in Afrocentricity, that everything has to be black. No, I don't believe that. All I want to do is find out what truth is. If it's black, it's black. If it's white, it's white. If it's Spanish, it's Spanish. I'm just interested in truth, not in, you know, making one group are superior than the other, and all of that type of stuff. We just want to find out what truth is. Now, and at this time, we've been on the phone for around 45 minutes, and what we're going to do, we're going to take a break for a second, because we said we would give everybody around 15 minutes, in case they have to use the bathroom or, you know, get something to drink or anything, and we can get back together in another 5 or 10 minutes. Now, are there any questions? That's what I first want to ask.
Well,
of what we covered so far.
No, there's just a lot of things going through my mind. You know, it's just
Yeah, that's why I want you to get a chance to think about it before we move to the next, because we don't want to just keep flooding you with information, and you need to get a chance to absorb it.
Yes, it wouldn't be. I guess it wouldn't be. I agree with you that, I mean, I'm really not into Afrocentrism, or whatever the name of it is, but I guess for me,